This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you.
Welcome back, everybody, to the People Speak radio show. I'm your host for tonight, Steve Johnson. The People Speak show normally airs every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific and 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS radio network. You can participate during the show with call-in questions for our guests toll-free in the USA and Canada on 1-888-429-5471. Or you can join us live in the government and politics section of Pal Talk, the largest free chat program in the world, where we have a virtual radio room, the People Speak radio show, that anyone may join to participate in the show. This is a great show tonight. I'm more excited than a junkie locked in a police evidence room. We are talking to honored guest right here, Mr. Brad Hoff, a former U.S. Marine who has lived in Syria and Egypt for some years and is now a prolific writer and researcher. You can find his research and writings on his website at levantreport.com and also on antiwar.com and many others. He is with us tonight to talk about ISIS and the Syria situation currently unfolding. Welcome to the People Speak radio program, Mr. Brad Hoff, sir.
Thank you so much for having me on, Steve. Great to be here.
It's fantastic to have you here. It certainly is. A lot of people with a lot of questions. But my first questions to you, we'll be taking audience questions after the first half hour, but my first question to you, sir, is what was it like living in Syria before it got all messed up with U.S. involvement?
Well, I got out of the Marine Corps in 2004 and was, frankly, very curious myself. I had never been to the Middle East in a kind of civilian capacity and decided to go to Lebanon and then on to Syria. And, of course, at the time, my parents and family thought I was crazy because, of course, Syria has always had a certain reputation. And I had had your typical, you know, Texas Southern Baptist upbringing and didn't know much about the Middle East. But when I first entered Syria and first few nights in Damascus, yeah, I was a bit nervous. It was just a foreign, very foreign land, foreign culture, as it would be for most Americans. I discovered right away, very quickly, some things that surprised me, like the relative secular public life, the fact that you have churches and mosques existing side by side in every major Syrian city. The people were wonderfully hospitable. Uh-huh. I expected some degree of anti-Americanism because, of course, this is a year after the invasion of Iraq, 2003 Iraq invasion, and it was actually not long after the Abu Ghraib scandal came out. But I discovered very quickly that Syrians are very critical of the American government, but do not put that on the shoulders of individuals. They treated me very well, very accepting, highly educated population, very diverse population. That was another big surprise. Again, as one who was quite sheltered growing up in a certain kind of atmosphere, in a very patriotic atmosphere, you know, believing the whole Bush narrative of axis of evil, and at some point later on, Syria, right, was included in that whole so-called axis of evil category. And so seeing Syria firsthand was basically nothing like any assumptions I'd ever had or any stereotype I had ever had.
Right. So what was your moment of clarity? What prompted your moment of clarity about U.S. militarism that woke you up to what you were doing was wrong? When did that actually happen to you?
Well, part of the initial catalyst towards visiting Lebanon and then Syria and Egypt before that was just doing some reading on my own in my last couple of years of life in the Marine Corps. And it started actually by discovering that there was a large Christian population present in Syria and even Iraq as well and in Egypt. And reading about that sort of uncovered other things that I had never been told. I had never been told the Middle East was actually quite diverse. most of the populations of these countries are not extremists or radicals, and that's what, frankly, a lot of people in my local area in Texas are sort of fed to believe, even though they lack experience of these places. And so I'd initially started reading, and it really simply took going there and seeing it firsthand. And in 2011, when you have the beginnings of conflict in Syria, I started following the media very closely, how they would cover this. And it was like night and day. The things I saw on the news through mainstream media, CNN, Fox, NBC, MSNBC, whatever it is, were almost, the picture being presented was the complete opposite of what I had experienced. From the start of this whole thing in 2011, you had this overemphasis on a sectarian narrative, right? As if everyone in Syria is going around and saying, I'm Sunni Muslim, or I'm a Shia, I'm Alawi, I'm Christian. In my experience, it was actually quite rude to talk very openly or publicly about religion, much like it would be rude in the United States or in much of the rest of the world. And actually, some of the families I stayed with early on, this was part of that that awakening. A lot of the families I stayed with, they didn't even know the religious or ethnic affiliation of their next-door neighbors, right? Their mentality was simply, I am Syrian. I am Syrian. And no one went around using sectarian language. In fact, the Syrian government doesn't even use sectarian language in its speeches, and yet throughout this whole thing in the mainstream media, they would have us believe that it's just this sectarian cauldron where everyone hates each other and everyone's at each other's throats because of religion. No, the defining factor in my experience of Syrian public life was nationalism, secularism, and pluralism. And in fact, especially modern urban areas of Syria, really not much different than experiencing downtown Los Angeles or any Western city. And I think this was part of this kind of orientalization of the conflict.
So you actually started off by joining the military because you believed the official narrative about 9/11. But having seen the media firsthand twisting those stories, do you still believe that Al-Qaeda could have pulled off that operation on the World Trade Center towers?
Well, I believe Al-Qaeda is less important, and the state sponsors behind Al-Qaeda are more important, especially, for example, Saudi Arabia and other countries that are allied with Saudi Arabia. And I think there's a wealth of evidence coming out and hopefully soon to come out as we speak. I'm friends with the man that runs the 28pages.org website. And so I think even mainstream middle American types who haven't heard or studied much about the events surrounding 9/11 are in for a rude awakening, because I think these 28 pages will soon be declassified, hopefully. And I think the declassified information alone, I think, will get more and more people asking questions. But I certainly bought into the big patriotic narrative just before I joined up. For me, when I entered the Marine Corps, the world was very black and white, good guys, bad guys, cowboys, Indians, and it's a very sort of Hollywood narrative, which I think is impressed upon us from when we're young. And I still have very much had that narrative of the world when I first started traveling in the Middle East, but I just began to see things that made that very simplistic narrative, it just slowly faded away. I just began to see things that were the complete opposite of everything I'd ever been told.
Yeah. In September, you made headlines across the internet, publishing the DIA report and exposing some of the fascinating facts inside the DIA report. What other evidence have you found, or is there, that ISIS are a U.S. manufactured and U.S. supported group?
Well, there's all kinds of evidence, and when I talk to people, I tell them, look, you can now understand this truth just by the admissions of current and former U.S. intelligence officials and State Department officials, okay? The two most important high-level confirmations of the accuracy of this 2012 DIA report, comes from a former Defense Intelligence Chief, Michael Flynn, as well as former Ambassador to Syria, Robert Ford. And their testimony, their public confessions, so to speak, are very important because these are two top men that were directly involved in arming the so-called Syrian opposition, which ended up being a bunch of foreign fighters, even according to our own State Department. Before I get to the admissions of Michael Flynn and Robert Ford, people need to look at something that, somewhat recently came out. The U.S. Department of State issued its country report on terrorism for 2014. This is a big, thick annual report, and you can find the whole thing at state.gov. And it's amazing their admission on Syria. And I'm going to quote from the State Department. The rate of foreign terrorist fighter travel to Syria during 2014, totaling more than 16,000 foreign terrorist fighters from more than 90 countries as of late December, exceeded the rate of foreign terrorist fighters who traveled to Afghanistan and Pakistan, Iraq, Yemen, or Somalia at any point in the last 20 years. This is an amazing, shocking document, a very public document issued by the State Department. And so you can even find multiple government departments that will sort of quietly admit these things, but of course big media won't pick them up. But this summer, I believe late July, Michael Flynn, again, former head of Defense Intelligence Agency, the DIA is kind of like the Pentagon or DOD's internal CIA. Michael Flynn was in charge of the DIA when this 2012 report was written, indicating that the U.S. had knowingly supported groups that would become ISIS, knowingly supported al-Qaeda, was in fact using al-Qaeda to try to topple the Syrian government. Michael Flynn goes on Al Jazeera with a man named Mehdi Hassan. It was Al Jazeera International. Sadly, it never aired in America. It, for a while, Al Jazeera's YouTube channel was geo-blocked in America if you tried to access it, okay? But an international audience saw this, and there's Mehdi Hassan. The specific episode is called Head to Head, Al Jazeera's Head to Head. Mehdi Hassan has the printed 2012 DIA document in hand, and he said, "Did you see this?" Michael Flynn says, "Yes, I saw it." And he confirmed the accuracy of what was in it. Mehdi Hassan even pressed him, "So you're saying the White House willingly armed al-Qaeda and groups that soon after would form the core of ISIS and Islamic State?" And he said, "Yes." He said, "Yes, we knew." He even goes so far as to say it was a willful decision, because Mehdi Hassan actually gave him a way out. Mehdi Hassan said, "Oh, so they just didn't know. The White House was looking the other way as these weapons went to al-Qaeda, bin Ladenite-type extremist terrorists." And Michael Flynn says, "No, I think it was a decision. It was a willful decision." And that's stunning because Michael Flynn himself has a history of being very hawkish. He's a war hawk. I mean, you know, Michael Flynn is not usually very trustworthy, but this was a very candid admission. And perhaps even more important is former Ambassador to Syria Robert Ford, that helped oversee this whole so-called uprising, and who was the State Department's top man in Syria, basically helping the CIA and U.S. government get weapons to so-called moderate rebels. You know, you can even go to Robert Ford's own Twitter account. It's at FordRS58, and I confirm that this is indeed his Twitter account with a top Syrian expert at the University of Oklahoma. His name is Joshua Landis. There is a Middle East journalist, well-known, writes for Al Monitor online magazine. His name is Edward Dark. On Twitter, he asked the following question: "Do you deny knowing that most of the moderates you directly backed fought alongside ISIS and Nusra on the front lines in Aleppo in 2013? On Twitter, very publicly, Robert Ford says, "I absolutely do not deny this. I criticized them in 2013 and 2014. And he kind of tries to backtrack. Later on, Robert Ford admits the same thing to McClatchy newspaper. These guys are all over the place publicly admitting their role in helping create ISIS. They should be in prison. Unfortunately, no one is paying attention to this.
Now, one thing that really impresses me about your writing and your research is that you name the names. You actually tell who these people are and what they're doing. Can you tell the people who are listening here today a little bit more about Abu Omar Shishani, otherwise known as Omar the Chechen? What's his role within the ISIS U.S.-sponsored group?
Sure. A couple of months ago, McClatchy newspaper in D.C. did a big investigative report that uncovered that Abu Omar al-Shashani, now known as Omar the Chechen, he was actually trained by U.S. Special Forces in 2006 and after in Georgia. Abu Omar is of half Chechen, half Georgian origin. And, of course, the United States during that time had a very close relationship with the Republic of Georgia on the Black Sea, still does. And it's one of these sort of forwarding NATO operating bases against Russia. And so it was revealed by McClatchy newspaper that Omar the Chechen had actually been trained by U.S. Special Forces. Sometime in 2012, he enters northern Syria through Turkey. And that's what my reporting kind of emphasized. It followed up on McClatchy newspaper's Mitch Prothera's reporting. I just took it a bit further, and using a recently written book by a man named Benjamin Hall, who gave firsthand confirmation that Omar the Chechen had been on the ground in northern Syria during that time. And, you know, using some old Al Jazeera footage, I was able to piece together that Omar the Chechen had been fighting directly alongside Ambassador to Syria Robert Ford's top man in Syria. This was a Free Syrian Army commander named Abdul Jabbar al-Okaidi. And he was head of what's called the Supreme Military Council of Aleppo. And this is the group that was receiving very officially, very openly, this wasn't even secret, State Department funds. His salary was being paid. Supplies and weapons were being shipped in. And you can go watch this Al Jazeera footage, which I linked to in the article you referenced. And you can watch the FSA guy whose salary is being paid by the United States fighting alongside and celebrating military victories with Abu Omar al-Shashani's men. At that time, they were known as the Army of Immigrants and Helpers. It was his band of Chechen jihadi terrorists. And this is all on video. It's all quite out in the open. Literally, the command structure that we were supporting, we were directly supplying, we were funding, was exercising operational command over Abu Omar's suicide bombers, who went in and took a government military base in northern Syria called Meneg Air Base. And so it's all right there, very much out in the open. This is part of the reason why Robert Ford had to admit later on to McClatchy newspapers his role in all of this and giving flooding northern Syria with weapons and money that eventually went straight to ISIS because, of course, it's all about plausible deniability. He admits that we knew all this was happening, but as many now know, it's all about branding, right? The FSA itself was a kind of international branding campaign to market the rebels in Syria to the West. And it turns out a large, perhaps vast majority of them were not even Syrian. They were international extremists and terrorists. For example, ones that we've been working with going all the way back to the early 1980s.
So they were rent-a-terrorists, in fact.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Like I said, that State Department document I referenced gives confirmation. According to the State Department, more than 16,000 foreign terrorist fighters from more than 90 countries in 2014 alone. That's just 2014. And so, yes, you can describe many of these guys as foreign mercenaries. One of my favorite Middle East professors, his name is Assad Abu Khalil. He runs the Angry Arab website. He usually refers to the Free Syrian Army as the Fee Syrian Army because they will only fight for a fee.
Right. So in your opinion, how many of these fighters in Syria at the moment are actually Blackwater or other types of mercenaries? Do you think most of them are?
I wouldn't go that far. I do think we've had men on the ground for a long time now, even going back to 2011. I would highly recommend reading WikiLeaks' newest book, The WikiLeaks Files. It has an entire chapter on Syria, and it shows that we were pushing hard for regime change as early as 2006. And, of course, many of your listeners might know that we were pushing for regime change in Syria even before Bashar al-Assad was president back in the 90s with his father Hafez al-Assad. The neocons have long eyed Syria in order to ultimately bring down its ally, Iran. But yeah, we know that going back to 2011, if you've seen the WikiLeaks, when they leaked the Stratfor document, Stratfor is a private intelligence agency that closely contracts with the U.S. government. It's actually located right here in Texas. Its headquarters is in Austin. You can read emails and notes from meetings taking place in the Pentagon that talk about special ops, special forces guys being on the ground in Syria, even in 2011, close to the very start of this entire thing back in spring 2011, and they're trying to foment discord and chaos. But of course, why get your guys in there directly? Why get the U.S. special ops guys or even Blackwater in there directly? And if you can, ultimately, you can train your mercenaries for hire in places like southern Turkey or Jordan. So I'd say that Western intelligence agencies would tend to want to use third parties, and so they're not going to put a lot of their guys on the ground. And, of course, that's all about plausible deniability, so that when they get caught, like they have been, they can say, well, we didn't know, or we didn't do it directly.
Yeah, well, we never saw that memo.
Right, exactly. Your listeners ought to check out an organization called Conflict Armament Research. It's based in Britain, and I actually linked to one of their reports in the article where I first exposed the 2012 DIA Salafist Principality document that we were discussing. They did a report, and they actually traced serial numbers recovered from ISIS fighters by Kurds back to a CIA Saudi program to arm the Syrian rebels in 2012. So, wow. I mean, we have all kinds of evidence. We have video evidence. We have serial numbers. We've traced weapons back to their sources. We have former officials like Michael Flynn, Ambassador Robert Ford, and, you know, we have a host of intelligence guys talking to people like Seymour Hersh, right, who wrote his expose on the chemical weapons false flag back in August 2013. So, you know, we have so much evidence. The good thing is I increasingly meet people that don't follow very closely who know by now there is something not right about the official narrative that's been spun.
And I remember also a story came out about 6 months ago about a Texas plumber's Ford F-100 pickup truck that was traced to Syria and was actually being used by ISIS, even though it had been sold in auction in Texas. Do you remember hearing about that?
Oh, absolutely. I kind of got a kick out of that one because this is a town I've traveled through often. And just a local Texas plumber guy gets a big surprise. Now, as far as the Toyota pickup trucks, yeah, that actually, as you know, that actually got some mainstream big media attention lately.
Yes.
Of course, they didn't connect all the dots. Just a little personal anecdote. I returned to that issue recently because I'm about halfway through one of the more well-known books on the Afghan-Soviet War, and it covers the Afghan-Soviet War from early 80s all the way up, and then it covers Afghanistan all the way up to 9/11, 2001. And it's probably the most famous book recently, you know, New York Times bestseller. It's called Ghost Wars. And actually, that author was talking about how the vehicle of choice for the Afghan and Arab mujahideen, which were fighting the Soviets during that time, as the Toyota pickup truck. And if you pick up this book, like in Barnes & Noble, you can just open it up and see pictures inserted, which show these Mujahideen guys in like 1985 using these bunch of these pickup trucks. And I was looking at some declassified stuff that were referencing Toyota, and it seems that history is repeating itself, and the parallels are clear. Because it's what I think Western covert intelligence organizations did. They simply tapped into the same playbook that they used when Al Qaeda was born, and when they used Bin Laden and company as assets in Central Asia against the Soviets. And so I was amazed. The parallels just keep coming.
So these stooges use the same template, whether it's for the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, for ISIS, or whatever terrorist group they want to fund next, they use the same template time and time again.
Absolutely. You know, and people shouldn't be under any illusion about President Obama. It's often said that, well, he's not doing what Bush did. He's not doing a big old invasion and bombing. Well, he wanted to in 2013 after the chemical weapons incident, sure. But Obama is going back to the Reagan playbook, right? And of course, during the Reagan era and just before it, it was all about the Contras in Central America, and it was all about basically building up and supporting death squads to go in and basically remove or install whatever puppet dictator we wanted at the time. And so, yeah, Bush was all about the overt, the criminal overt military intervention. Obama, I think, is trying to keep people under the illusion that, you know, he's this Nobel Peace Prize winning president, and he's not going to go in bombs a-flying against Damascus. Nope. But we've recently found out that the armed the terrorists, mercenary for hire program in Syria over the past few years is far and away it's the biggest, largest CIA program, and I want to say it was to the tune of $2 billion. I could be wrong. Over the past few years, and no, this is not some kind of peacetime president. It's a dirty war. It's a dirty war, and he's going back to the Reagan years of Contra death squad style dirty wars, but this time in the Middle East, sadly.
Right, right. What about your thoughts, your personal thoughts on al-Bashar Assad? Is he really the dictator that's painted by the Western media?
Well, certainly Syria is no democracy, right? But at the same time, one of the things I came to understand when I was there is that Syria is not about one man. Assad has come to symbolize the Syrian government, but the Syrian government has legitimate institutions. It's a sovereign state. And you know, people I talk to who are completely against the rebels, it doesn't always necessarily mean they're huge Assad fans either. Much of this, it's all about one man, it's all about Assad narrative that's been spun is completely false. You will never hear the voice of common Syrians, as in common Syrians who haven't picked up arms and they're not fighting on one side or the other. I mean, when was the last time anyone turned on CNN and spoke to someone, just a regular person, who simply said, I'm a secular Syrian, and I'm not some person that worships Assad, but I certainly don't want my country taken over by foreign-backed extremists. And so it's not about Assad, it's about Syrian sovereignty. And in interviews, Assad himself has said things like this. I'm not going to cast this as purely as innocent victim. Innocent victim versus pure evil, but I don't think it's bad to say that the Syrian government has committed crimes. But the fact is, any country that's been invaded by a foreign terrorist army would react to defend its citizenry. And actually, the greatest number of refugees are actually the internally displaced refugees. And where do they tend to go? They tend to, when they are internally displaced, they tend to go to government-controlled areas because they want sanity. And the Assad government, you know, might not be the best thing on earth, but it's certainly not. It's certainly not the what's been painted in mainstream media, as if from the start it was the Syrian government going around and just offing people on the streets. They were responding to a foreign-backed insurgency. Some of the same fighters that were bombing U.S. troops in Iraq, al-Qaeda in Iraq, once it entered Syria, you know, became the CIA's personal tool of regime change. And so all sides have done bad things and committed crimes, as would happen in any kind of grinding civil conflict like this. But the fact is, this wasn't some spontaneous thing. It got to this point because from the start, it's been about covert regime change. And no one is actually interested in peace, not the external players. Syrians on the ground are certainly interested in peace. There's been a lot of local ceasefires sponsored by the government and you know, some local people who had been living in rebel-held areas. This is not a narrative of simply a kind of civil war or protesters in the streets, freedom fighters rising up. This thing was planned from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Stay right with us, Brad. This is the People Speak Radio Show. I'm your host, Steve Johnson, talking with very special guest and political researcher, Mr. Brad Hoff, live and direct across the internet and across the world. And we'll be right back with our guest and audience questions after this short message break.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Today's school libraries are filled with endless opportunities. With access to print and digital materials, the latest technologies, and the guidance of a school librarian, our children are empowered with the tools they need to succeed in school and beyond. I'm Julianne Moore. Join me in celebrating all of the ways that school libraries and librarians are transforming learning for our students. For more information on how you can become involved, visit the American Association of School Librarians at aasl.org.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
Hi, I'm Richard Bowser, and this is the great BBS Radio.
This land is yours.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
Thanks for joining us again. You're listening to the People Who Speak radio program, coming to you live across America and across the world. I'm your host for tonight, Steve Johnson, and we're back with our very special guest. He's a political analyst and has his own website, LevantReport.com. He's a contributor to Antiwar.com and has done his homework about Middle East politics. Welcome back there, Mr. Brad Hoff, sir.
Thanks so much. Enjoying it.
Now, the stuff that you've been talking about in the first half hour is mind-blowing. It should be on the front pages. It should be the news headlines all across the world about how America has admitted that they're sponsoring and paying for and supplying and supporting these fanatical terrorist groups in the Middle East. That should be everywhere. Why do you think that the media is not talking so much about this?
Well, I mean, personally, it's been difficult for me over the past decade undergoing a kind of personal transformation. After 9/11, all we were told is Al-Qaeda is out to get us. Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda is the eternal enemy of the United States. And like I said before, I bought into that narrative, patriotic, young Marine. But many of these illusions were shattered starting by just going there and talking to the people and existing within Middle East society, and specifically Syrian society. But of course, propaganda in the United States is very powerful, and I'd recommend for anyone Noam Chomsky's classic work, Manufacturing Consent. He says that propaganda in the United States is not like old Soviet-style propaganda. It doesn't exist within a totalitarian state where the government owns the media, owns the medium of communication, but it exists through a close, symbiotic, corporate-government relationship where big media thrives so long as it touts the government narrative and government gives access to big media and favors it. And so I think a lot of this is simply good old perception management. Perception management was a term, I believe, coined during the Reagan administration. You simply manage the assumptions that go into the narrative, and it even boils down to terminology. An example is recently in the Washington Post. Washington Post headlined an article talking about how the United States should support and fund a group called Ahrar al-Sham. Ahrar al-Sham, any Syrian analyst knows, is simply another iteration of al-Qaeda. So like I said before about Free Syrian Army from the start simply being a kind of branding operation to market the rebels to the West. Again, this is a lot of it's about labels. And, you know, your average Joe Sixpack sitting at home in middle America, you know, he doesn't get up in the morning and think about Syria or Iraq and their internal dynamics. And so I think it's not their fault, but it's very easy to get very confused because it's a complex issue. And it even comes down to the labels and assumptions were fed. And unless you pay close attention or unless you've actually been there, or unless you speak the language, it's actually going to be hard to filter through. And so you need to know who to listen to and what sources of alternative information to seek out.
We do have a question from a listener in California. Jane Bond is her name. She asks, now earlier you talked about the neocon plan to invade the Middle East. Is this not part of Israel's plan for a greater Israel?
Oh, sure, yes, and this was stated back in the 1980s, and I believe it was like an international Israeli-sponsored publication talked about the greater plan for Israel expansion, and it involved basically targeting powerful states that existed in the region and fragmenting them. Basically sowing discord and chaos because it's easier to control a sovereign nation when that sovereign nation is fragmented and bogged down in some sort of grinding civil conflict. And so I actually think that's where we stand now in Syria. I'm not convinced that everyone in the U.S. government wants to see the immediate collapse at this point. Not everyone in the U.S. government wants to see the immediate collapse of the Syrian state, but they are quite happy to keep it burning. They are quite happy with sowing fragmentation and chaos, hence the sectarian narrative I mentioned before. It's just overplayed, and it's not true if anyone's actually been there and experienced Syrian society. And the way it usually goes is you know, the Syrian government is Alawites and everyone rising up is Sunni. Well, this is not true. The bulk of the population that supports the Syrian government is actually Sunni. They simply want a tolerant, secular, pluralistic state, unlike the fanatics that Washington, London, and Paris are supporting. And so, yeah, this plan involves the fragmentation of any state that could pose a threat to Israel, and certainly that's a part of this. And of course, Israel has become closely aligned with the Gulf Cooperation GCC states like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait, who we are also in very close alliance with.
We have a question from Eugene in Ohio. He would like to know, is this part of Wesley Clark's admission to invade 7 countries in 5 years, what we're seeing in Syria today? Is that part of that neocon plan?
Sure, I think so, absolutely. I don't know that there's specifically a kind of playbook that people are consulting in a smoky back room, so to speak, but on an ideological level, there are certainly enough people in Washington behind the levers of power that are following this plan. So, Syria has always been the most important strategic center in the Middle East. I mean, look at its location. It itself does not sit on a huge wealth of oil, but it's always been seen as a very important location, linking, of course, Mediterranean and Central Asia. And, of course, you know, as Wesley Clark said, the grand prize here is ultimately to bring down Iran.
We have a question from Mike in California. You mentioned an American ambassador confirmed that the USA is backing ISIS. Now, what specifically is the USA doing? Are they supplying arms? Are they supplying money? Are they supplying training? And is it coming from our CIA, our military, or a go-between?
It's a difficult question. I'm going to say with 100% certainty that in its origins, ISIS is where it is today because of Western intelligence, CIA. There's a lot of people that speculate that this is a continuing relationship, that there's some kind of covert intelligence operation room that's running ISIS. I don't know that. I go by what I can confirm. I think it's legitimate to speculate that. I think it's legitimate. If you're a student of history, you know we've backed brutal death squad groups just as fierce, just as horrid as ISIS before. I do know that the groups we are very publicly, openly, directly backing are, you could describe it more as traditional Al-Qaeda. And of course, you know, there's been a kind of schism between ISIS and Al-Qaeda, or at least that's the official narrative. There's talks of some kind of Al-Qaeda-ISIS reconciliation. But with certainty, we are continuing to back sort of standard, traditional, vanilla Al-Qaeda. When Idlib fell, the most important city in northern Syria, a man named Charles Lister, an analyst from the very hawkish official Brookings Institution, he himself admitted there's an operations room in Turkey where CIA personnel and from other intelligence groups from allied countries were directly running the operation that involved, I think, the group, the rebel coalition at that time that took Idlib was called like the Army of Conquest. And, of course, the most dominant fighting force in Army of Conquest included Jabhat al-Nusra, which is traditional al-Qaeda in Syria. So, yes, with 100% certainty, we are running traditional al-Qaeda in Syria, which I don't see there's much separation there in terms of brutality and violence and terrorism from ISIS. As far as if we're directly running ISIS, I don't know. I do know we are allowing ISIS to continue west of the Iraq border. So I think we probably have tried to hit ISIS hard through coalition bombing and things like that in Iraq. But the idea is to contain ISIS to the other side of the border. The idea is to contain ISIS and keep it marching toward Damascus in order to put pressure on the Syrian government, as the 2012 DIA document predicts and confirms. So I don't know if that's a direct relationship. We're probably just letting the Saudis and Turks do a lot of that. Again, it's about plausible deniability. Even these guys, these bureaucrats in Washington, fear that maybe one day, 5 years from now, some administration will try to prosecute them and put them in jail, which is something that should happen. And so that's why we often use intermediaries. So ultimately, I don't know. Maybe a good, juicy, declassified document will come out somewhere in the near future, confirming such.
We have a question from Christian Missionary in Chicago. Is the leader of ISIS a Mossad agent? I believe he's referring to al-Baghdadi, otherwise known as Elliot Shimon, in your opinion.
I just can't know that. Interesting thing about Baghdadi. We do know it's a nom de guerre. It's a pseudonym. It's a false name. There is a big special operations website. It's a community of former special operations guys that now write sort of political analysis based on their experience in special ops. It's called SOFREP. I think it's SOFREP.com. The leader of that website, I want to say he's a former Navy SEAL, Brandon Webb. He has a good article talking about there is no single Baghdadi. That when Special Ops was operating in Iraq, when it was occupying Iraq, they would always hear about some kind of mythical Baghdadi, Baghdadi over here, Baghdadi over there, commanding al-Qaeda in Iraq and the Islamic State in Iraq. And even these Special Ops guys know that the Baghdadi thing is just a label. I have no idea who it is, but I very much doubt that it is the person, you know, we've been told it is, or the person we've seen in photographs and in video footage. Ultimate answer is I don't know, and I'm not going to speculate on that. I think it's fair game for people to speculate. I think there's a danger, though, to the alternative media movement. People need to make it clear when they are speculating, or when they have 100% solid evidence. So I think it's a worthy avenue of research, but we need to be careful of not overstating things.
And of course, he was the guy who was photographed next to John McCain. Is that not true?
Again, I don't know. To me, it doesn't even really matter, because we do know for sure that the group that John McCain claims was there, Northern Storm Brigade, we do know for sure that many of those guys belonged to al-Qaeda in Iraq and had fought against American soldiers when they were occupying Iraq. We know that much with absolute certainty. Time magazine had a reporter on the ground that interviewed these guys close to that photograph incident with John McCain, and they admitted quite openly to Time magazine that, we were fighting with al-Qaeda. We're veterans of the Iraq insurgency, and now that we're here in Syria, America is backing us directly. Going back to Omar the Chechen, in 2013, when Omar the Chechen and his jihadi terrorist fighters were sieging the Syrian government's Meneg air base, Northern Storm Brigade was filmed right there fighting alongside them. So yes, I think it's fair to speculate, because that much, what I just said, is confirmable with absolute certainty. As far as anything beyond that, I don't know. It's speculation, but I think it's a worthy avenue of research. But ultimately, I don't know.
Yeah, we have a question from MW in Oklahoma. What are your thoughts about Russia getting involved in Syria as they have recently?
Well, it is Russia's geostrategic backyard. And the media has spun this narrative that Russia just up in one day wanted to support its dictator, Bashar al-Assad. Well, no, Russia has had a defense infrastructure and security relationship with Syria, with the Syrian Ba'ath Party, going back decades. When I was there for a number of years, there was a large condominium complex that people would call Little Russia. There were actually Russians, a lot of Russians in Syria who were engineers, especially engineers, scientists. There was a Russian cultural center off of a famous square in Damascus called Yosef Azmeh Square. It's near Martyr Square as well. Russia has long had a cultural as well as defense relationship with Syria. And so I think it's more like simply Russia had enough. I don't see this as a kind of offensive decision, as in Russia is the aggressor. I think it realized that the West is building a terror army in its own backyard. And if this terror army is allowed to take over and then fester, it's going to show up at Moscow's doorstep. So if anyone, frankly, has a right to do some kind of larger intervention in Syria on behalf of keeping Syrian sovereign, it is Russia.
Fantastic. Good answer. We have a question from Love is Light in New York City. Do you think they lied to us? As a former Marine yourself, do you believe the U.S. lied to the public about how Pat Tillman died?
Well, yes, absolutely. Actually, funny they asked that, because I just went by Hastings Books about two weeks ago and bought the well-known book. I think the author is, John Krakow, I think. Wrote a big investigative book about the whole Pat Tillman issue. Yes, absolutely. It was in the Army's interest to lie. And, of course, they had done everything they could to market his image. And, by the way, if in case anyone missed it, last week the Los Angeles Times, L.A. Times, ran an article about the Pentagon's close relationship with the NFL. To the tune of giving the NFL millions of dollars to host these very elaborate, patriotic, for lack of a better word, rituals before every game, and to encourage a kind of relationship between the NFL and Pentagon, which would lead to more recruits going into the military. So sure, it's a big, big image campaign, and the Pentagon is involved in this just like any other department of the U.S. government.
Do you think they're doing that at this point in time because nobody's joining the military and they're actually down on numbers?
No, I think in a way it's part of our American DNA. I'm actually currently a high school teacher, and just this week I was talking with my history students about American exceptionalism. And it's a strand that I think we can... It's a kind of American cultural myth, a cultural mentality that goes all the way back to Jamestown and the early settlements. It's just, I think, part of our DNA, that kind of a kind of uber patriotism that we see ourselves as a light to the world, and that's part of my own upbringing, that I really thought America was special, and therefore everyone should listen to us. And part of just simply traveling abroad, which what I would encourage any young person to do, broke those illusions, and I came to see that other nations, other cultures are simply, we're a lot like them, and they're a lot like we are. There's really nothing special about anyone. We're all, I think, broken and bent towards evil, and our country is certainly no better than any other. I think we're quite worse, actually.
Right. We have a question from Alex in Missouri. Why do you think Syria is being targeted at the moment? Is it because of the petrodollar? Is it maintaining the strength of the U.S. dollar? Or is it because these countries refuse to play along that have been targeted so far, like Iran, Iraq, and Libya? What do you believe is behind it all, yourself?
Well, of course, I think it's multifaceted. There are other people that have done better work on this particular element, but yeah, oil is a part of it. Syria doesn't sit on top of a whole lot of oil. It has some natural gas and some oil fields in eastern Syria. But there's been talk of a pipeline running through Syria, and I know Qatar has long wanted to see its pipeline put into place, which would go to the Mediterranean, which would involve it going through Syria. My understanding is that Syria a few years ago nixed this idea and opted for, I think, another pipeline that originated in Iran. And, of course, this helped the powers that be put a target on Syria. I think it's also the fact that Syria has never ultimately become a puppet of the United States and the West. But it's most especially, I think, simply the Israel issue. Syria has really never compromised, like, well, let's say the Gulf countries or Egypt. It's maintained a consistent position in resistance to Zionism and Zionist expansion for the past decades. And Syria has long been a target, and actually, I would describe this whole thing as more of a long war. If you read, there's a famous book written by probably the foremost, historically the foremost scholar of modern Syria. His name is Patrick Seal. It's simply called Assad, and it chronicles the Muslim Brotherhood uprising in the early 1980s, and the Muslim Brotherhood tried to assassinate Hafez al-Assad and took over an entire city, Hama, and the Syrian government put it down. And in the book, it actually describes U.S. weapons and communications equipment being found in the hands of the Muslim Brotherhood fighters who had tried to topple the Syrian state and make it more of a Saudi Arabian-style Sharia state. So this is actually a long war. This has been going for a long time, and as your earlier the earlier question indicated, it is bound up and tied up with that greater Israeli-Arab conflict. Sure.
We have one last question, only time for one quick question. Do you support the stop funding of Israel by American taxpaying dollars?
Yes, I do, and that was another interesting sort of awakening. Believe it or not, when I first visited Israel, I was very pro-Israel. It just so happened that my youth hostel, the hostel where I stayed, was in Palestinian East Jerusalem. I stayed near the Damascus Gate. Probably many of your listeners have stayed in the same hostel. And again, it was a matter of simply seeing it on the ground. I was shocked. What I saw was a sea of Palestinians. It was clearly Palestinian land, and basically a few Israeli heavily armed military personnel, you know, standing atop the walls and the towers of Old Jerusalem, you know, basically keeping them under occupation. So again, it was seeing it on the ground that first made me realize it was way more complex than I had been fed. Number two, made me realize that, again, a lot of Palestinians, most Palestinians wouldn't take up arms or become suicide bombers. Again, that's what we're sort of told in Texas, that all Palestinians are suicide bombers ready to commit terrorism, things like this. These were just normal people under the thumb of a horrible occupation. And actually, I was interrogated and strip searched by Israelis upon entering the country and upon exiting, because I had Arabic writing on my passport. And so I personally experienced the difficulty, even just for a week or so, of the occupation, and I wasn't even a Palestinian who had to stay there.
Well, you've been listening to the People Speak radio show with special guest Mr. Brad Hoff. I'd like to thank him and remind all the listeners to visit his website at levantreport.com. Thanks so much for being on the show today, Mr. Brad Hoff, sir.
Thank you so much for having me on. It was great.
Excellent. Join us coming up soon on the People Speak show when we talk to the documentary maker John Pilger and possibly even Russell Brand in the near future. Stay tuned for those interviews coming soon. Big thanks go out to the producers Mike, Doug, and Donald, and to all my friends throughout the world and all the guys who give me so much support. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. You can tune into my own channel called Stop Funding Israel, but for me for now, take care. Hope you enjoyed that one just as much as I did, and bye until next time.
One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the steeple, by the relief of us, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry.
Okay, ciao.
And I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me.